The city's been decked out for the holidays with a total lack of restraint. The street lights, the decorations, the headlights of the other cars, reflections off windows and slick roads. It all gives me a killer headache. What my dad calls a bastard behind the eyes. At a stoplight, I press my eyelids down, push the knuckles of my fingers into them to try to give some relief. The bright spots still intrude through the soft skin, white shapes swimming in the red like something pure, drowned and drifting in blood. Driving Baby Home by Nicholas Papakonstantinou. When I open them again, the light has changed and the car and I sit idle at a crossroads, the only vehicle left on the road. I push down on the gas and we both lurch on. I try not to think about the things behind me, the thing in the trunk and the mess I left back at the apartment after things went bad with Jenny. A half hour later, and I'm almost out, almost on the open highway. Not even been driving for an hour yet, and I'm already losing it. The song keeps cycling through my head, and I can't shake it. I don't know the tune that well, just the one line, and it keeps repeating over and over. Driving home for Christmas. Driving home for Christmas. Fucked if I know what I'm going to say to Mom and Dad. I haven't seen them in 4 years. They haven't heard from me in nearly as many months. I've no idea why running to them occurred to me. I dread seeing them at the best of times. Less than an hour down now. Upwards of 4 hours left on the road. And I'm already drifting. Panicking. I guess that's why I stopped for the guy. I don't spot him straight away. So I have to swerve in and slam on the brakes. And he has to jog a little to catch up with me. His piece of cardboard tells me that he's headed to the same place as I am. When he opens the passenger door and pokes his head in, I see that he's around 18, 20. Gives me around 10 years on him. I fight down the urge to tell him that he's heading in the wrong direction. Buddy, he tells me when asked his name. He seems a little nervous, holds his backpack on his lap. Good-looking kid. Dark hair, long enough that he has to keep shaking his head, flick it out of his face. He don't look like a buddy, but what the hell. I'm not a cop. I just need some company to keep my head straight for the long drive. We drive in round about an hour, making good time out of the city, making a little small talk. I don't find out much about him, but then I'm not asking. Neither's he. After a while, he starts to relax a little. Decides the bag is getting heavy. Tries to fit it into the foot space in front of him. It isn't a big car, and he struggles. When I glance over to see what he's doing, he's bending forward, and I notice the hard metal bulge of the gun sticking out of the back of his waistband like something out of a movie. He notices me noticing, and nerves flicker across his face again, like he's trying to work out whether to try and look dangerous or go the other way. But I get the feeling his nature would get the better of him if he tried to push either stance too far. I shrug and look out of the window. My message of, what the fuck do I care, pretty clear. He struggles some more with the bag, and I take pity on him. Hold on, I say, and I pull the car to the side of the dead highway. I pop the trunk, and when he looks back in the direction of the sound, I nod and say, go ahead. Thanks, he says, and gets out. A few moments later, I hear him yell, what the fuck is that? Damn. I did too good a job of pushing it to the back of my mind. I get out, go round and see him standing a few yards away from the back of the car, staring. I follow his look down into the trunk. I'm guessing it isn't the other assorted clutter he's freaking about. I'm guessing that it's the large sample jar, green-tinted in the moonlight. It's big enough to fit a human head. The shape, swimming in the turbulent mess of formaldehyde in there, is barely visible, but unmistakable all the same. The brain tries to retreat away from it, pretending it hasn't noticed the tiny fingers, the curve of the tiny head. And the result is more distressing somehow, as if the object is less tangible, less real. I cover the slippery curve of the jar with a grey blanket that I keep back there for emergencies. Hiding it calms him down some. Enough at least to let me take the backpack and cram it down into the remaining space in the trunk. Slamming the hood down seems to snap him all the way back to the here and now. And he looks at me, quizzically. "Inside," I say. "It's fucking cold out here." Back in the car. Doesn't start first time. Takes a little foul play, a little coaxing. He stays quiet while I tease the rental back to life. Once we're back underway, I figure I might as well broach the subject, so he don't have to. "The thing in the trunk," I say. "It's my son."
"Your son?" he asks.
"Yeah," I say. Look over at him. Look back out onto the blacktop. "I'm taking him home to my parents' place, while I work things out."
Right,
he says. Looks at his hands, then says, "Right," again. But this time it's obvious that that's an end to it. He sighs, and the seat creaks gently as the tension seeps out of him for the first time, bleeding into the car. "You okay? You look pretty freaked out."
"No, I mean... Yeah, I'm just... Well, it's been a hell of a day," he says, and grins.
"You want a drink?" I say, eyes off the highway again.
"Hell yeah,"
he replies, and I signal towards the glove box where the liquor is. We share a drink, a few laughs, and drive on into the night, towards my hometown, my parents, whatever the fuck the future might bring. My father, when he was around, would often take me on long hikes in the roiling, rolling countryside surrounding our hometown. When his mood was light, as it sometimes was, he would point out bits of scenery and make up stories about them. "What do you see when you look at that tree?" I remember him asking one time.
It's got bright red leaves," I said.
"That's right, despite the season. What else?"
I'd rack my brain. My father had a military temperament. Never seen violence tempered by hard-trained restraint. I sensed it, even as a child, and that, as much as love, meant that I always tried as hard as possible to please him. God Kings by Nicholas Papakonstantinou.
"It's... got a very round shadow?"
"That it does. Like a perfect circle, right underneath."
He tousled my hair. "But look at the morning sun, low in the sky. That sort of light brings on the long darks. So that tree is in the wrong." Even now I remember my eyes widening as I realised that he was right. I looked around and saw that our own shadows were elongated far behind us. I look back at the tree. "You see, son, long ago, long before you were born, there were no trees here. But what there were the most brave and fierce warriors you ever imagined." I always stood a rapt audience when he spun these tales, and he relished the attention, I could tell. It made us so happy to be a part of the telling together. And that spot right there is where the noble God King Mantilok stood and fought off the monstrous hordes of his enemies, but was finally struck down by a retreating coward's blow. He probably had tears in his eyes at that point,
He always seemed so immersed in the tales. As he lay, dying, his blood drained and soaked into the soil, and he was so powerful a man that it darkens the dirt still and colours all that grows there. Some wars, you see, never really end. Even as the scars of them mark the land, the same battles still rage on somewhere, out of sight, waiting to be rejoined. Of course, as a child, every word your parents say sounds so plausible, and it never occurred to me to doubt the veracity of my father's stories at the time. The world they took place in seemed so real to him that it became real to me. He would tell me about a wild heritage we shared, about ancient debts and duty deferred. Most of my life has been spent trying to unpick the stories he told from every other memory of him in his absence. I can't remember what he liked to eat for breakfast or whether he drove a car, but I have clear and vivid memories of him standing tall on some hillside, the idea of ancient warriors standing at his side as clear in the memory as he is. These, if one's parents are good at the job, are the three stages of our lives with them. First, we believe unconditionally. Then we challenge, almost unilaterally. And finally, if we're lucky, we begin to actually understand. I think that is where I am now, with both of them. I think I know why my father felt the need to spin his yarns, to try and bring a world that he understood and still felt the pull of into the one that he shared with my mother and I. An attempt to make it real here so he could stay. One that failed. And I think I understand why my mother, who had to deal with my challenging years alone, kept the stories alive, even when they strained credulity and our relationship. About where he had gone, telling me that he was off to war on secret missions, providing alibi for his desertion of his son. I haven't seen my father since I was 12. My mother died without ever changing her story about the secret war that he is still apparently off fighting somewhere. But the tree still stands there, and all of his other landmarks besides. And I suppose the stories also remain. I came to this place for sanctuary, and instead find myself in the thrall of a theological debate. I have told you, and I know not how to tell you again, Father. These misshapen limbs and body are those of a man, one of God's own creatures. And I beg you to give me a place here to rest my lowly head.
That you are a man is not in question, my son. It is your assertion that you are the son of the doctor on the hill that cannot be ignored. And the lie you tell, that you were born to that man in absence of a wife.
That is his name. It is not mine. By Nicholas Papakonstantinou. I look beyond him, into the dark and candlelight of the dry and warm cavern of worship there. I look back down at the old man, my eyes rheumy and wet. I wipe the mucus that gathers in lieu of real tears with the back of my hand. It is no lie, Father. Have you ever heard tell of a lady companion for the doctor down these long years? Or indeed, of the echo of a child's laughter along those long and empty corridors.
look at me with merciful eyes? Could I have grown as a normal child to this great size without gathering the attention and rumours of the servants that come up and down from the village? He looks at me, a mixture of impatience and incredulity on his face.
But what you say is an impossibility. And if it were not, it would be blasphemy. Man cannot be born of man alone.
I am young yet, but my life thus far has been hard and has taught me much of irony and hypocrisy. I cannot help an abrupt wave of my grotesque and massive hand, asking his attention back inside the church. I have not much experience of being loose around others, and I move too close to the old priest. His momentary recoil of fear makes me falter. But my point is a valid one, and I make it again. Who decides such a thing? Look inside, Father. Look up there, above your altar. What, of a man born of woman alone?
This is foolishness,
he exclaims, and moves back slightly into the shelter of his church, ready to close the door on this poor brutish fool. For that is yet how he sees me.
You test my patience, sir. It is only the Lord's mercy that stops me thrashing you soundly where you stand. Our blessed Virgin Mother Mary was visited upon by the Spirit of the Lord. Would you have me believe that the doctor was as well?
He cannot help a sly laugh at that, but the smile soon leaves his face in the cold push and pull of the wind and the rain. I should go and leave him to his peace. But it is so cold out here. The rain pouring down, the lightning flashing across the sky, and deep inside me something moves. The fluttering of the newborn's fear of the dark. And Father will soon realize that I am gone. Soon there will be more to be scared of in the night than the lightning and the dark. I go to my knees. Please, sir, I am telling you the truth. My father is a good, God-fearing man, but he is also a servant of science, and science to him is also some sort of God. Science is the spirit that visited him and aided in my conception.
And what? Should I think that you were grown from a seed like some twisted tree?
No, sir. My father, in the grip of his genius, found access to the remains of the dead. From that gruesome clay he made me. The priest grimaces, but then his face softens. God help me, I think he may be pitying me.
My son, do you believe that you were stitched together from the bodies of the past? Did I make you out to be a charlatan when actually you were some poor, feeble-minded creature?
No, sir. I am born of my father's dreams. His dreams are great and terrible, but were no more terrible or more great than those of any other parent, I'm certain. But his dreams are also beautiful and fragile, like clear-cut crystal or finest bone china. And I fear that holding them in these clumsy, brutish hands, they will be shattered. I hold one hand out and up to the old man. And I was not stitched together like some poor girl's doll.
I grew as any other child, but in a bell jar of vile and stinking liquid. The suspension fluid helped to form me out of the broken-down meat of the dead. Father saw that I grew fast and without the nurturing of a female womb. See the smoothness of my skin. And I forced my hand into his, like no man born of woman. He folds his hands over mine, first curious, then frantic, as he sees the truth of it. No marks on my skin. He pulls away the cloak that covers my naked flesh and sees my body, as slick and smooth as my fingertips. No navel, in fact, no markings at all. I am fresh and new and hideous as Father made me.
What kind of unnatural creature are you?
Not unnatural, Father. My creator is one of God's creatures. By natural law, that must surely make me one of God's creatures as well. I feel the sting of rejection as he forces my hand violently away from his own fingers and retreats into his church. I watch him go, and for an instant I force my eyes away from his judgment of me. Look up at the ornate stonework above the church door. I had seen it from the path and thought it beautiful, considered it a symbol of my shelter from the cruel rain. Now it just looks like stone. And I am still looking on it when the blow comes. Something sharp and harsh and metal against my heavy skull. The priest returned with something, a weapon of some sort from inside the house of God. I crash to the wet ground with my full weight, my arms going up to shield my head from the continuing blows. My face presses down into the sucking mud as I try to push myself forward, but my stupid, addled brain. This takes me towards the entrance of the church, pushing past the attacking priest, where I will be trapped with whatever comes next. Here, half inside the church and half out, there is no room for the priest in the doorway. He has to be content with raining blows down upon my legs and back. He cannot reach my shoulders anymore, so I raise my head. I had been most afraid for my eyes. From here, I can see the altar clearly. From here, I can look up at the large crucifix that towers over it. So large it would dwarf even me were I to stand before it. From here, I can see the salvation that I had believed so fervently in for what it is. The eyes looking down on me through tears of blood mark this out as a cathedral to nothing more than pain and sacrifice. And though I had been pragmatic when bargaining with that priest for entry, I can see now that the man on the cross and I are more alike than different. But he was followed before he was betrayed. He had a life. He was a leader of men where I will ever be a pariah and a monster. As I meet his eye as his equal, I choose to focus on the seemingly endless, monstrous pattern of assaults on my body. I choose to clench my fists beneath me.
and I realize that what I am going to do next will be a choice too. One that defines me. I had hoped to leave my father's home and find my place among other men, but I've realized now that I am not a man. I am something else, and something more. And I am damned if I will let them crucify me before I've had my time. Moments later, I look at what I have done. It won't be long before the local folk find the remains of their priest. And then they will be coming for me, with my father, the doctor, close behind. Let them.
My father was the greatest of us, and when life finally brought him low, as it does us all in the end, it was my sacred task as his youngest son to lay him to rest. With two wives and goodness knows how many other men and women, the hard work of several lifetimes, and many children and more grandchildren, with more than a few dozen battles in more than a couple of wars, it was still no surprise that it was his heart that did for him. It was just too big, too full of those women, those children, all of those fallen comrades and other comrades besides still taking a swig at the bar. So, I carried his meat and his bones, as is tradition, over one of my 2 weak shoulders to the chosen place, the place picked out for his best-fitted memorial. And I rested his carcass down on the soft earth before the bare, flat rock sheet that stretched on as far as the eye took you. And I set to work, at first slowly, but gaining speed with every exertion. This is how I did it. As Every Father Ever Did, by Nicholas Papakonstantinou. I chose my spot in the rock, and I flexed my slender craftsman's fingers and tested my tapered craftsman's hands. I touched the spot in the rock that I'd chosen. I drew back my hand into a fist and uncoiled it at the rock as a scorpion's tail. The first cut ached in my mind, as it always does, as my mind always did, recoiling at the impact of extended fingers on rock, before remembering that this caused me no pain, that my hands glide through rock as steel through sinew, or a storyteller's breath through a lie. Because father was born a warrior and a man and a father, but I was only born a builder, simply a stone shifter, and this is what I do. So, I scooped out giant boulders of rock, won a hand, and tossed them to one side, shoulders strengthening with each throw, until I'd hollowed out a place in the permanence of stone for my father. I lifted him into it. I said the words. I tried to remember him as best as I could in that single moment, as clearly as my simple stone shifter's heart would let me. And I buried him, returning the stone with him beneath, rock on boulder on bone, until all the stones were returned and his heart
underneath, pushed them into a mound. And then I kept on, tearing up fresh rock, gouging pools and then valleys in the steady, ancient face that nothing had previously marked, not allowing the tears in my eyes out onto my face, building and building, making a hill of my father, always so steady, always so sure, making a mountain of him, his shadow always reaching out, his silhouette never far from the horizon. For days I tore at the world, building fitting tribute to my father. Weeks, until I had nothing left to give. And then I fell and slept for a year, hands reaching out, a weakness in our world. Hands reaching out to the mountain now, where my father stood before. When I woke, the grass had grown around me. A year of inertia and entropy and the natural world on my skin. But the mountain stood. There are others that I've built now. Other mountains, other memories. And for everything that I have built with intention, I have devastated lives and torn canyons out of the world through lack of care. But in my father's memory, I try to build more often than I break as I move through this world. And every year I return to that place and I add a few more rocks so that now my father, the mountain, stands still taller than before. So that now, as ever, I stand before you in his shadow. This selection of short fiction was written by Nicholas Papakonstantino and performed by Dion Winton Pollock. You can find these pieces in The Room Next Door, published by Marcosia, copyright 2019. Links to the author, the publisher, and the book can be found in the show notes, along with attributions for the music and the sound effects that I've used. The Room Next Door was a Fine-Toothed Comb production.